the child, but you can't stop the teen.
So it's way better to teach them, a modesty and their privacy as well, yep. And other parts of life. Thank you, brother, for being with us. It's a deep topic, but that's all the time we had for today. Thank you, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In the midst of hunger, shelling and displacement, many in the Sudanese capital Khartoum still find time to follow the world beyond. Tehran's resoluteness against Israel in a region where others have chosen silence or normalization with the oppressive regime is sparking something deeper here. In Sudan, it's personal. This is the same city where after the 1967 Arab-Israeli war, leaders gathered and declared the three no's, no peace, no recognition, and no negotiations with Israel. That legacy still lingers in the hearts of many Sudanese, not just as a political stance, but as a matter of principle and pride. Despite the struggle for daily survival, from finding food to fleeing violence, Sudanese civilians remain emotionally engaged in what they see as a larger fight for justice. The cause of Palestine still holds symbolic weight, and Iran's bold posture doesn't go unnoticed. Just as Israel is seen as an occupying force in Palestine, the RSF is seen here as an internal invader, a militia turning cities into battlefields. For people caught between rubble and ration lines, resistance anywhere feels like something worth noticing.
We followed closely the missiles Iran launched at Israel to defend itself, which is a legitimate right. Israel is supported by countries like the U.S. and European countries.
We followed the Israeli attacks on Iran, a sovereign and respected country. This aggressive regime has oppressed the Islamic nation and the Palestinian people. I pray that Allah grants victory to both Iran and the Islamic nations.
Even in a city scarred by war, the echoes of international struggle still reach deeply. Iran's actions remind many Sudanese that silence isn't the only option. Dignity, even under siege, can still speak and be heard. Here in Khartoum, the war is local, but the struggle feels global. As Iran stands its ground and asserts its influence, many Sudanese see a mirror of their own fight, a people refusing to accept silence or submission. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Foreign journalists walking through the ruins of residential neighborhoods, witnessing the human cost of war firsthand. Each destroyed home telling a story. Personal belongings buried beneath the rubble, lives forever changed, and families left shattered in the wake of Israeli missile strikes. One of the hardest hit areas on June 15th was Tehran's Tajrish Square, normally a busy shopping hub.
The innocent blood that was shed will never be forgotten. We will never forgive or forget these atrocities.
Traffic CCTV footage released a week later captured two powerful explosions. The first struck the upper floors of a building. The second hit the street, rupturing a main water pipeline and sending debris flying across the square. Vehicles hurled into the air. The blast left behind scenes of chaos. At least 12 civilians killed and more than 50 injured. Amid the devastation, residents rushed to help one another, pulling the wounded to safety from the flooded, debris-strewn streets.
We had to act quickly to minimize the damage. After the explosions, the street was left with a massive crater and severe flooding.
Local residents and shopkeepers recounting the harrowing moments, the deafening sound of the blast, the frantic rush to find shelter, and the heartbreak of returning to shattered homes, destroyed storefronts, and neighbors who never made it back.
We invited you here to witness the scale of destruction caused by the Israeli regime, so you can be a voice for the war crimes committed against the Iranian people. No awakened soul or conscience can accept this level of disregard for human rights.
The tour then moves to Tehran's Narmak neighborhood, where a university professor, labeled by the enemy as a nuclear scientist, was targeted in his own home. The attack claimed the lives of the professor's entire family and several neighbors. Now the residence lies in ruins, reduced to rubble. And what remains is a sobering scene, a stark reminder of the human cost behind what Israel describes as targeted assassinations.
It's very disturbing to see all these belongings to the children, like the school books, the plays they have, and to see like they are completely innocent and why they got killed. I mean, even the scientist also, he was not working on any atomic bomb, he was working on civilian nuclear facilities. So this is against the Convention of Geneva to attack civilians.
Through every stop, foreign journalists hear firsthand the voices of survivors, and they view evidence that directly contradicts Israeli claims of avoiding civilian targets.
Visiting more bombed homes, the foreign journalists witnessed the true human toll of the Israeli aggression, the devastating reality of the suffering of civilians. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
More than 170 civil society organizations joined a massive pro-Palestinian rally in Dublin on Saturday. Protesters strongly condemned the Israeli regime and its Western backers, accusing them of enabling genocide in Gaza.
They're attacking with high-precision military equipment that they're getting from the United States, and what's now being accepted as just normal international behavior means that we have people who are being dehumanized and demonized if they try to defend themselves.
Campaigners are calling for immediate sanctions on Tel Aviv and a total ban on the use of Irish airspace for the transfer of lethal weapons to Israel.
International law is there for a reason. So Israel needs to adhere to international law. That's all we're asking for. Please adhere to international law. And if everyone done that, we wouldn't have ended up here in the first place.
Official figures indicate that nearly 59,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, have been killed by Israeli forces since October 2023. The real death toll is likely far higher. Meanwhile, famine is now imminent. The long-anticipated Occupied Territories Bill is expected to be introduced in Ireland this September. If passed, the legislation would ban trade with companies operating in illegal Israeli settlements.
In recent days, high-profile political figures in the United States have been mounting pressure on the Irish government to scrap the bill, threatening negative economic consequences if it goes ahead. But these activists are demanding that political leaders here do not capitulate to that pressure. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
The echoes of the Iran-Iraq war still speak through walls. At Tehran's Holy Defense Museum, a delegation of foreign journalists walks through the scenes of sacrifice, endurance, and defiance. An immersive journey into the eight-year imposed war, where a nation bled but never broke.
Quite striking what they did, tried to capture the atmosphere of how it was, and also to show it to other people who didn't went through the war, who didn't live through the war, and don't have actual account of it. So it's pretty amazing what they've done.
The Holy Defense Museum in Tehran stands as both a memorial and a mirror of Iran's resilience.
The first impression upon entering this museum is a deep sense of the Iranian people's extraordinary resilience and unwavering determination. Despite enduring severe hardships during the eight-year war, when virtually the entire world stood against Iran, they persevered. Even in the challenging years following the revolution, Iran managed to overcome immense obstacles, ultimately emerging victorious and displaying remarkable strength.
From reconstructed front lines to artifacts of fallen soldiers, the museum offers more than history. It conveys a message that victory comes not just through arms, but through faith and national unity. The journalists listening closely as the guides explain how the Iranian people, civilians and soldiers alike, stood shoulder to shoulder to defend their homeland. The experience led the visiting journalists to draw powerful parallels between Iran's wartime past and its present-day resistance to foreign aggression.
Things like peace through strength and, you know, peace through war, all this just nonsense. It's nonsense. And what I'm taking from this museum is Iran never sought out war or aggression upon anyone. And all of the war, the imposed wars upon Iran, they never sought that out. It was imposed upon them by imperial powers.
As far as these foreign journalists are concerned, the museum underscores how, for Iranians, defending the homeland is deeply rooted in their faith, culture, and collective identity.
Here, the visiting journalists see not only the scars of war, but the unity, resilience, and overwhelming faith that has led to the victory of the Iranian nation. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Italy's former prime minister and opposition five-step movement leader Giuseppe Conte has accused Giorgia Meloni's far-right government of violating international norms by maintaining military ties with the Israeli regime.
Si chiama genocidio.
What is happening in Gaza goes under the name of genocide. The genocidal intent is evident. Italy's government has made a mockery of the country by not requesting any sanctions against Israel. We expected you to at least tear up this memorandum, as Italy's military ties affect support violations of human rights and international norms. How do you intend to continue importing weapons from Israel? This is an act that makes you complicit in the violation of international law.
Conte's remarks came after Italy's Chamber of Deputies rejected a motion by opposition parties, five-step movement, the Democratic Party, Greens and Left Alliance, and Italian Socialist Party, to suspend a 25-year-old Italy-Israel Memorandum of Understanding by 142 votes to 102. The memorandum revolves around Rome and Tel Aviv cooperation in the military sector. On June 8, while the Israeli regime's genocide in Gaza continued to escalate, Italy's government renewed its military cooperation agreement with Tel Aviv. This memorandum of understanding, in place since 2005, is automatically renewed every 5 years, unless one of the two parties explicitly decides to suspend or terminate it. In late May, in response to the regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza, the regional governments of Puglia and Emilia-Romagna formally severed all institutional ties with the Israeli regime. Italy's national government has not even been able to speak a word of solidarity for the thousands of civilian Gazans slaughtered by war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu.
C'è una sudditanza che giustifica.
Italy is utterly subjugated to Israel. We keep supplying Tel Aviv with military materials, including ammonium nitrate and tritium, and importing weapons from Israel. The amount of arms we imported tripled in 2024 compared to the year before.
Our motion was a strong message given by all opposition forces in the face of Netanyahu's brutal attacks that continue to kill Gazans and hitting even a Catholic church in the strip. Our government must condemn once and for all Israelis' extermination of Palestinians.
Italy is the third Israeli regime's arms supplier following the U.S. and Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Dozens gathered on Khalid bin al-Walid Street in Damascus, rejecting Israeli aggression and expressing firm support for Syria's unity. The strikes, which hit near residential areas, were seen as a provocation aimed at deepening internal strife. Protesters raised Syrian flags and voiced rejection of sectarianism, foreign plots, and war. Many see the airstrikes as part of a wider plan to reignite conflict and shatter the country's fragile recovery. Chants echoed through the streets. No to treason, no to foreign intervention. Protesters called for civil peace and solidarity with Soweda, vowing to defend every inch of Syrian territory against division and outside manipulation. From Damascus to Soweda, Syrians are speaking in one voice. No to war, no to division. As Israeli airstrikes try to fracture the country, citizens respond with defiance and unity stronger than ever. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
His name may not have made headlines, but to those who knew him, Hajj Ramazan was a legend. Now, in the wake of his martyrdom, an entire nation commemorates the life and sacrifice of Major General Mohammad Said Izadi, known by friends and peers as Hajj Ramazan.
He dedicated over 35 years of his life to the Palestinian resistance. He was a key figure in supporting Palestine as he was head of the division in charge. His unwavering commitment shaped the resistance movement and earned him respect for his dedication to the Palestinian cause.
A key force behind Iran's support for Palestine, he was revered for his humility. His martyrdom in the recent Israeli aggression has drawn widespread condemnation and renewed vows to carry forward his mission. A special tribute video played during the memorial left many in attendance deeply moved, as they admitted they had never realized just how instrumental Hajj Ramazan was in support for the Palestinian resistance.
Those who support Israel are stabbing Palestine in the back, and those who martyr the supporters of the resistance are betraying Palestine. What this revered martyr left behind is a legacy of resistance. We must keep his memory alive by continuing his path in the fight against oppression. What better honor than to sacrifice for this valuable cause?
This memorial affirms a collective vow to preserve the memory of martyr Hajj Ramazan and continue his unwavering support for the resistance, echoing across generations and all who stand for justice.
Honoring this revered martyr, his steadfast commitment to defending and supporting Palestine inspires continued resistance. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, raising good people. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z. You're on Arab English Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and obviously raising good people. Raising good people is something that obviously in Islam we do both as parents, educators do this, or teachers, university professors. But in a sense, we're meant to be doing this no matter what our status is, no matter what our role is in society, because really, how do we raise good people? So we raise good people in a sense by ourselves being good, because people, everyone will be, you know, we all look at each other, we all observe each other. So if we are observing someone else with good behavior, that has an impact on us. So that can help us to be raised as good people. And the other way of obviously raising people is to actually give specific instructions, advice, and guidance. So that's two aspects. I'm just going to first refer to a particular sorts of behaviors in the life of one of the most famous martyrs from Lahore Defense, Dr. Mustafa Chamoghan. So it's said again and again that his personality had very special effects on people around him. So for example, there was actually a group that came from the Lebanon to fight with Dr. Chamoghan in Iran during the Holy Defense. And it said that they all became martyrs and nobody even found out who they were. But it said, what is said about this particular group is they were just as humble as Dr. Chamoghan, and they were fighting only for the sake of God and duty. And then the comment that is added to that is that this is something that was happening with the people who sort of came and joined Dr. Chamoghan in whatever situation, whether this was fighting, whether this was working with him, that he was actually raising people like that. So people who, for example, were told, even if they were totally unknown, but they were indebted to God. Welcome back to A to Z here on R&B English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea of raising good people and how we raise good people. And obviously I've mentioned we can raise good people by being the best we can be, because, you know, we learn from observing others. And then the second way is to actually instruct, advise, and guide through words, for example, as well. And I've mentioned the example of Dr. Chamoghan, who in everything he did basically seemed to raise good people in many different ways. And obviously, so what's the lesson that we take from this? And obviously our martyrs, you know, obviously these, they have very high ranks. And obviously I'll just say again, we cannot ever think of our martyrs as dead. They are truly alive. And many people will actually say this, especially the families of martyrs, that they do even feel the presence of the martyrs. So be aware of that, that the martyrs are even if you visited them at their graves, grave sites, they are very much amongst us. And people even ask them for help. So the lesson is, so what do we do? So what can, how can we follow this example of these sort of martyrs and trying to raise good people? And obviously I've mentioned that we need to also, first of all, focus on what we are doing. Because in a sense, and the suspicion is some of these, many of our martyrs, they did not even necessarily give specific guidance. People were going to them and just watching them, just being in their company, and that was already changing them. So rather than, because obviously our tendency is, you know, we want to open our mouths and we want to speak and we want to say, and maybe we say it really beautifully, but is it really that important to always tell people do this and do that? Maybe we can also guide just through being the best kind of person we can be. And And obviously there is people who manage to purify themselves, really focus on getting rid of flaws in their character. You know, there is, they do say that there is a special light, and people, if you manage to do that, other people will be drawn to you and they will gain huge benefit from being around you. So let's maybe just focus on that. Let's just focus on polishing, training our own character, first of all. Essentially, these are, let's say, insights, reminders for all of us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on IRB English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. We start this hour's lineup with leader's speech. The program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the honorable leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Then it's time for a spotlight. The program covers the most important events happening in the world today with roundtable analysis and discussion. And our final program this hour is our varied radio productions feature.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials and the ambassadors of Muslim countries. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on March 31, 2025. Today, events around the world are taking place in rapid succession at a staggering pace, whether in our region or in other parts of the world. This rapid pace at which events are taking place necessitates that all those who see themselves as being either influential or affected by these global events keep up with these events quickly and carefully and state their position. Today, Islamic governments have this duty. Islamic governments should think carefully about their own nations, their friends, their enemies, and the events that lie ahead and await them. The Islamic world is quite large. We Muslims have a large population. We are situated in a critical geographical location in the world. And in terms of the world's natural wealth, we rank among the wealthiest countries and communities in the world. If the Islamic world wants to take advantage of these critical situations, it needs to take a fundamental action, unity, the unity of the Islamic world.
Subhanallah.
Unity doesn't mean that governments should merge together into a single entity. It doesn't imply that they must think alike in all political orientations. The unity of the Islamic world involves, first and foremost, recognizing common interests. And the first step, they need to know what their common interests are. We shouldn't define our interests in a way that would lead to discord, conflict, and strife among ourselves. The Islamic world is one family. It's one whole. Islamic governments must think about this and move in this direction. The Islamic Republic has extended its hand toward all Islamic governments and considers itself to be their brother. As the president just stated, it considers itself to be with them in one general fundamental front. Let's work together and put our minds together. Let's maintain unity in the Islamic world. If we do this, the aggressive, oppressive, coercive powers won't be able to attack the Islamic world, impose their will, or blackmail them. Unfortunately, extortion and blackmail have become the common practices of the powers today. Major powers blackmail weaker countries, governments, and nations, and they state this openly. Let's not allow the Islamic world to be blackmailed by the US and the likes of them. We must defend the rights of the oppressed. Today, part of the Islamic world is severely wounded. Palestine is wounded. Lebanon is wounded.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
true day, a new way. The feeling that's all deep inside, the faith in our hearts will always rise.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And while the Israeli regime has been successful in its many years of occupation and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and their homeland behind U.S. and European political and military cover, there are emerging dynamics now challenging the status quo. Ongoing Gaza genocide has impelled more and more states, organizations, and bodies to find ways to restrain Tel Aviv's barbarism against Palestinians and its reckless adventurism throughout West Asia. From the ICC this week refusing to revoke arrest warrants for Israeli leadership, to an Irish boycott bill of Israeli settler products dubbed the Occupied Territories Bill, and Slovenia barring two Israeli ministers in the current cabinet from ever visiting the country. And these small but highly significant mechanisms of restraint and a few more, the focus of today's Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us, Mr. Paul Lerutico, founder of the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Berkeley, California, in the States. And Mr. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Gentlemen.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I think this is the first time I have Paul, both you and Sayed, at the same time. It's a pleasure. Hope both of you are doing well in your respective neighborhoods there. I guess, Paul, we'll start with you. It's been a while since I've checked in with you. Hope you're doing well in Northern California. When we see the U.S. And most European countries showing no sense of urgency in addressing the Gaza genocide, Paul, how important is it that these other balls start rolling?
What do you mean, no sense of urgency? The United States is urgently sending all the weapons and taking them from Ukraine to Israel. They urgently want to support the genocide in Gaza by every means necessary. I call that urgent. I think you meant something else, but
no, that was well put.
Clearly,
Paul, but basically the small movements and avenues of restraint, how significant do you see them being? We know that they don't stand up to U.S. vetoes. We know they don't stand up to all the lobbying by in Europe and also in the States. But there has to be some silver lining. What is it?
Well, as you know, the United States Congress is in the complete control, at least on this issue and actually on several other issues as well. By the Israel lobby, AIPAC, but it's also other organizations that have a stranglehold on our more than just the Congress, actually. It's a great part of government. So the people, there have been efforts by groups in the United States and individuals, massive numbers of individuals have individually written to members of Congress and the government and demonstrated and written articles, and it's been the subject of social media and all this sort of thing. It's very clear that the majority of the American public, despite all the propaganda to the contrary, is opposed to this war. But the government goes ahead because the government knows that if someone who is opposed to the genocide in Gaza gets into an official role in the U.S. government, the lobby, the Zionist lobby, will destroy them and take them out and find somebody to replace them. So this is this is the problem that we face in the United States. I would have to say, the efforts are worth doing, but they're not as effective as the efforts that you cited that are taking place in other countries.
All right, fair enough. Thank you for your initial thoughts, sir. Paul Saeb, Mohsen Abbas, welcome. Thank you for your patience. And your initial take, please, as well, on these growing mechanisms of restraint, Saeb, and how significant you see them, if at all effective, in further ostracizing Israel.
Well, first of all, I think it's a miracle that we've got to the stage where finally, after 2 years of genocide, we have nations who are beginning to speak up about very basic issues. And I think the kind of things that I picked up were, pledging to cut the military ties, the idea of also putting sanctions, some sort of economic sanctions, trade, cutting diplomatic ties. These are all things actually which the UN rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, was very, very keen on. And she also pointed to the EU particularly failing from her point of view, because they have doubled the size of trade relations with Israel. They actually are their top trading partner, as it were. And that, simply the fact that they even, the EU even, are even beginning to talk about some kind of suspension of economic ties, it's a miracle, and it's not really enough, of course. She's saying, well, suspend the entire association agreement, which, according to international law, you're obliged to do under the circumstances. But, of course, the EU and the US and all those Zionist imperialist regimes don't really want to do any of this. It's just that now it's almost probably becoming so untenable within their own populations, who are having a meltdown about the way Zionists basically control Western governments, that it's almost becoming embarrassing for these politicians, and they've got to be seen to be doing something. The Hague Group, of course, are probably better than most, and those eight countries, there's a chance that we're going to get these embargoes going and some sort of sanctions scenario. Because as the Colombian vice minister said during the talks in Bogota, he said that what's gone on in Gaza is an affront to international order. I'd say it's an affront to civilization and humanity, frankly.
Okay, now I'm glad you brought up Bogota there, Saeb. Paul, the UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine, Francesca Albanese, recently the first to be directly sanctioned for her work to address the Gaza genocide, fight for Palestinian rights by the Trump administration. She made her way down there to Bogota to attend this the Hague Group conference consisting of 12 countries. She was able to get a consensus. She had everybody calling it a genocide, which is huge. And consequently, the 12 countries agreed to bar any arms sales to Israel. What kind of victory do you see this as?
It's a victory. But I think some of the other things that they discussed, such as actually sending forcibly food into Gaza with troops that will not accept to be turned away. It was brought up, but that's probably the only thing that is going to be effective, or something like it. Basically, Israel has to feel real pain in order to desist in its crimes against Gaza and against Palestine. Otherwise, they are going to say, "We can wait it out. That's okay. We don't need trade with this country or that country, or we can manage without it. We can get everything we need from our partners, especially the United States, which will get the supplies that we need and figure a way to do this." So, it's good. It's a very good start. It's encouraging, but there have been lots of encouraging signs since October 7th, almost 2 years ago. Mm. So I don't know. I'm not holding my breath on this.
Thank you. And the International Criminal Court said it will not revoke arrest warrants that it issued for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister and ex-war minister there, Yoav Gallant. And also this week, a U.S. court also said the Trump administration is sanctioning the three ICC judges and their boss, chief prosecutor there, Karim Khan, who issued these warrants, that it's dead wrong, that there's no legal standing for it. How do you gauge another small victory here with respect to the ICC, Sayed?
Well, I think it's definitely, again, a step in the right direction. If the ICC or the ICJ have any credibility as international legal entities, Netanyahu and all those involved in genocide should be arrested in any country they land in, to be fair. That's the compliance that should happen. They should be handed over to the courts, and the courts should deal with them according to the evidence that's already been presented and the tons of evidence that's been accumulated since that ruling, which has been ages. Most people say the ICC, the ICJ, the UN, frankly, they've all failed. They haven't done nearly enough. They've not really participated in synchronizing any kind of real legal punishments on Israel. They've not been boycotted. They've not been banned from any international bodies. They're still members of the UN. They're still members of all of these other institutions. I mean, Russia, by comparison, was hammered very quickly. You know, sanctions and the lot, really. You know, so to be honest, it's not good enough. But something is better than nothing. What to really be happening, of course, is that Israel should be boycotted in every way, shape, or form. There should be no diplomatic relations with them. And the real way forward, ultimately, has been shown by the Yemenis. And I'm hardline on this. But you go and look at Eilat Port today. And Eilat Port is now bankrupt. It's declared bankruptcy. 90%, maybe even 100% of its trade is now completely shut down. And that was because the Yemenis made it clear that nothing was going to go through the Bab el-Mandeb to Eilat port. So Israel wasn't going to get its domestic supplies. And I think that showed how quickly, just Yemen on its own, how badly it hit Israeli trade, and the economic impact of that would have been huge had it not been for Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan creating another trade route via the sea and land to continue the trade supplies which Israel needed. And of course, the US and the British, particularly the Germans as well, have been flying in weapons consignments on a regular basis, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of military items and hardware. And quite frankly, all of this, I can't see how this lifeline and this murder line, this kind of killer line, is going to be stopped, because Britain and the US are still committed to supporting Israel. And this is the crux of the issue. Everybody wants to put plasters, and we're all supposed to be really grateful that anything happens. But the reality of the matter is that Israel itself is a rogue entity. It's an illegal entity. It's a colonialist project which is occupying a land that belongs to another people, and it shouldn't exist. That's the reality of the matter. The whole world ought to not just be begging for Israel to be sanctioned with a few little arms embargoes here and there. What they should be saying is, how on earth do we sort out this rogue nation which has nuclear weapons at its disposal, and psychopaths in control of them? I mean, how on earth does anybody sit comfortably knowing that Netanyahu and his band of psychopaths, who basically don't think genocide is anything, anything of a problem, have nuclear weapons, and they're willing to bomb at least five or six countries at any one time around them, causing chaos and mayhem, which will potentially all affect the whole of the region. I think far stronger measures have to be taken, and the world needs to wake up, and it needs China and Russia and the big boys to get involved as well. It can't just be these kinds of nations who are sort of relatively lightweight.
Very well put there, Sayed. And Paul, how do you gauge the ICC's defiance in standing up for the Palestinians here? And this is a U.S. judge siding with the ICC and standing bold-faced in front of the Trump administration when it comes to not reinforcing these sanctions against ICC judges.
How do I see an exercise of integrity? I see it as normal. I see it as the way it should be. And for us to consider it extraordinary to have this display of normal judicial integrity is a telling sign that we don't expect it. We don't expect integrity in our judicial system, neither the global system nor in our domestic systems either. And the same holds true for enforcement of any of the international laws, including the Genocide Convention, which, of course, the representatives of the fledgling nation of Israel were instrumental in creating, and they welcomed, and now they are the worst offenders of the Genocide Convention. And the rest of the world, under the Genocide Convention, which basically all of them signed, with some exceptions, they're not following their obligations under the Genocide Conventions to stop all support and to practice all enforcement measures in order to prevent and stop genocide wherever it appears. What happened to all of that? It's a farce. It's clear that in today's world, if not since the beginning of time, that might makes right. And if enough nations are willing, like the Hague Group, for example, that's not, I wouldn't say they're necessarily enough, but it doesn't take a large number of nations to say, hey, let's all get together and send our armies and our cargo ships to Gaza and dare Israel to hit us. Well, yeah, if it's just one or two, and if it's and depending on who they are, it might not be effective. But if you get enough who already have shown that they are enforcing restrictions on Israeli trade and international travel and diplomacy and so forth, if you get enough of them together, it can happen. They can actually, the kinds of things that Israel is doing now to kind of coerce the United States into doing its work, such as the strike against Iran. If other nations will do just the opposite and basically coerce the international community into doing something to defend Palestine and Gaza and international law, then it might be possible, but you have to have a critical mass to do that.
Interesting points there. Thank you, Paul. And Sayed, just this week there was quite a significant setback. European Union was on the cusp, it seemed so, very close to pushing through punitive measures against Israel, but with some heavy Zionist lobbying, with the foreign minister flying in and who knows what went beyond the scenes, they put it off. Nevertheless, Spanish Prime Minister was irate. He's calling events in Gaza genocide. Ireland is passing legislation to bar any products from the occupied West Bank from reaching Irish soil. And this is to America's chagrin, which is relatively significant, I believe. And Slovenia has declared Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bilali Smotrich, to your point, a couple of psychopaths in this super extreme far-right cabinet, Benjamin Netanyahu's persona non grata. We don't want to ever see you on Slovenian soil. These are what many people call baby steps. That ideal you referred to, alluded to earlier, seems like we're, you know, quite a bit away. Yeah, we should be looking, how can we just flush this whole failed project down the drain? But apparently anything short of that, how do you gauge this slightly domino effect taking place in Europe?
Well, I think mostly politicians are really concerned about their own positions. And when their own public or their constituencies actually do start getting wind of the fact that all of their lies about human rights and about, democracy and freedom are basically being flushed down the loo when it comes to Israel, and that it's all basically hypocrisy and lies,